Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Sam, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Caregivers Coping with a Loved One's Metastatic Prostate Cancer. And this is part two of a two-part series, Living with Metastatic Prostate Cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And because of that collaboration, we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. So we have on the call today over 627 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, India, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really are from all over the world, and it's a bit of a global call. Today's program was made possible by Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is information about our speakers, the collaborating organizations, as resources for all of you with their 800 numbers and websites for you to get additional help. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you'd like us to offer going forward. Indeed, the program today was one that many of you had asked us to do, a program for caregivers, and so we have focused today's program on that topic. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to present for all of you updates on metastatic prostate cancer, current therapies, new treatment approaches, and clinical trials, and the important role of the caregiver. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to make sure that everybody who is a caregiver really listens very intently to today's talk. I think very often we forget how important the caregivers are because these are the people who need to know about side effects of treatment, know how to be there for the patient should that patient get into any sort of difficulty with the treatment, and just be there in general as a liaison between the patient, the family, and the doctor. So I'm sort of dedicating today's discussion to the caregiver. There are many new treatments out there for prostate cancer that has failed the conventional standard of care, which is hormonal therapy. And as many of you know, hormonal therapy works by stopping the production of the male hormone testosterone, which really drives the cancer. What we've learned over time is that in spite of making sure that testosterone does not stimulate the growth of the cancer, we've learned that some cancer cells, for example, will grow despite the lack of testosterone. These are what we call the hormone-resistant cell population, and these are the most challenging for us to address. These are the ones that do not respond to sometimes second or third manipulations of other hormones, and these are the ones that we really try to gain control of over the course of months to years. Now, we're very fortunate that within the last 2 years, we have had probably five new treatments, one within the last 6 months, in fact, all of which are directed toward treating patients who have failed hormonal therapy. And when we talk about patients who have failed hormonal therapy, these are usually patients whose scans have changed over the course of weeks to months, patients who may have disease in the bone or the lymph nodes or in lung or liver, and we're seeing really stupendous results with these drugs. The standard of care for patients who have failed hormonal therapy and have progressive disease, whether it causes symptoms or not, is to give a standard chemotherapy called docetaxel or Taxotere. This drug is very effective, and in fact, my own indications for recommending this drug is for a patient whose PSAs are either very rapidly doubling or tripling in a short period of time, despite other treatments. The second indication is for somebody who is just feeling weak or frail, not eating, not gaining weight. And the third is even for patients who have disease that is causing symptoms to them that might require receiving radiation therapy to control their pain. Because sometimes the radiation fields are so large, meaning that there are multiple sites to be irradiated, we really can't irradiate the whole body. And as such, chemotherapy can be used not only to control pain, but really protect the bone marrow against the effects that would be normally derived from the radiation therapy. So overall, very advantageous. Now, we do have the approval of the second-line chemotherapy. So if one fails standard chemotherapy with docetaxel, the next drug is cabazitaxel or Gevtana. And this has also been shown to be very effective for patients who have failed docetaxel. I might add that it is not beneficial to every patient. In fact, some patients may have some numbness or tingling in their fingers or toes as a result of docetaxel that could conceivably worsen on cabazitaxel. But it's an option, it's there, and it has been very effective for some patients. We have new oral medications that are really making the difference and have been approved in the post-docetaxel setting. So it's really up to your medical oncologist to make the determination whether or not you would be a suitable candidate for an oral agent, such as Zytiga, which is otherwise called or known as abiraterone, and another drug called Xtandi, X-T-A-N-D-I. The other name for that is enzalutamide. Both of these are oral hormone-like agents that have been approved for patients who have failed docetaxel. And it's really up to your medical oncologist to determine would you benefit better from having cabazitaxel as your next treatment, or should you go on to either Zytiga or Xtandi. Now, we don't have data to support using one in front of the other, meaning if you fail docetaxel, immediately give Zytiga or abiraterone, or if you fail enzalutamide or Xtandi, go on to Zytiga. We really have not been able as yet to determine what order would be best in terms of using these drugs. But for now, we have a free-for-all. The doctor can make a decision, and if one doesn't work, go on to the other. They are all safe. They have reasonable side effects. And for many of our patients who may not, in fact, be candidates even for chemotherapy, one could use Zytiga in the pre-chemotherapy setting. That has still not been approved for the Xtandi or enzalutamide just yet. But the point is that we're trying to move a lot of these very safe oral agents that have very few side effects much earlier than chemotherapy. And the idea is really to keep people going and to avoid just the idea of chemotherapy. You know, it's very funny because many people are afraid of the C word, and you think the C word would be cancer, but in reality, it's that chemotherapy. And it often gets a very bad rep. In fact, people come in for chemotherapy and go directly to work. And it's been really a pleasure to see how people can actually still continue to maintain quality of life using these going through chemotherapy. One word that I should mention is that there is an immune therapy known as Provenge by the Dendrion Corporation. That's a cellular product vaccine whereby your own immune cells are exposed to a particular protein in the laboratory. And after 48 hours, these cells that are now, I guess you can call them somewhat educated after their exposures, are returned to the body. It has been shown to impact on overall well-being, but has not had the same kind of impact as chemotherapy. And we recommend this treatment for those patients who, for example, have no symptoms or very few symptoms who might not be ready to go on to chemotherapy. A new drug, radium-223, otherwise known as Alpha Radin or Xofigo, X-O-F-I-G-O, is a radiopharmaceutical that was the most recent to be approved in this armamentarium against metastatic prostate cancer. It's a drug that is what we call an alpha emitter, which means it has a penetration into the bone marrow, but not to the extent that external radiation would have, meaning that side effects are much fewer, and this drug can be redosed to the patient with significant safety. This drug was based on, the approval of this drug was really based on a very large study in Europe, suggesting that it really did a great job of controlling people's pain and seemed to impact on their overall survival. And by the way, all these drugs that I've mentioned have impact on the overall survival of the patient. The side effects are very tolerable, and it's now being used in many hospitals and cancer centers to control pain. When I say control pain, it does not necessarily translate to shrink lymph nodes or diseases at other sites. It is specifically what we call a bone-targeting agent. So despite having this great armamentarium, there are many questions that often arise in the doctor's office about, gee, doctor, how do I know if my cancer is going to be very aggressive or very indolent and slow-growing? Well, we are in our heyday of looking at what we call genomic profiling, whereby sometimes we are able to get pieces of tissue from biopsies and look for genetic alterations or mutations. And the kinds of mutations or alterations is not important, except for the fact that we are trying to develop targeted therapies against these genetic abnormalities. But cancer is very smart, and very often a single drug may not be sufficient because the cell knows to develop what we call collateral pathways and tries to avoid the particular agent that's blocking it at one site. I want to reiterate one thing, and that is that you will see on the internet and other sites that, oh, please send us your tissue, we'll give you a genetic profile, we'll tell you what drugs to which these to which agents will be directed for these mutations. And the reality is they're not validated, they're not FDA approved, and really they're still considered to be investigational, although we are making significant progress in this area. Sometimes the PSA does not, for example, reflect the most significant treatment response, and we are looking for other correlates that will reflect the true biology of the cancer. And one such correlate that you may be hearing about is something known as circulating tumor cells. These are tumor cells that are in the bloodstream that can be detected through a FDA-approved test. And what can be done with these circulating tumor cells is that they can be monitored pre- and post-therapy. And if it turns out that the PSA is not doing very much or doesn't go down, doesn't go up sort of in sort of stable, one could measure the circulating tumor cells, which are cancer cells in your bloodstream, and try to determine whether or not the therapy has worked by virtue of a change in the number of those circulating tumor cells. So before therapy, if your circulating tumor cell was 10 and it goes down to 0, then there appears to be a significant impact on your disease. There's a huge learning curve because we are trying to find other means by which we can detect a change in the biology of cancer other than that of the PSA. What should be known, however, is that with the circulating tumor cells, you really need to have a fair amount of disease. There are some patients whose scans show significant disease progression, yet they don't seem to be shedding any of these circulating tumor cells. So the take-home message is that treatment choices should be discussed with your doctor. I would always defer to the doctor to determine what is the best course of treatment, what's the best order of the treatment, and how one can get a better understanding of the biology of this cancer. So I'm going to stop right now and go right back to you, Carolyn. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Slovin, very much for just a very comprehensive overview of metastatic prostate cancer and its treatment and the important role of caregivers. And now our next speaker is William Gorin, Bill Gorin, and Bill is the Director of Clinical Services at Cancer Care, and he is going to address who is a caregiver, stresses of family, partners, friends, and loved ones, coping with holidays, birthdays, and special occasions, long-distance caregiving, and self-care and stress management tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Gorin.
Thank you, Carolyn. In a recent article by Dr. Nancy Snyderman, she's a medical consultant to the Association of Retired People, she reports that she had recently become a caregiver for her ailing and elderly father. She frankly states that as a physician, she would be able to navigate the many branches of the healthcare system in order to provide her father the quality of care she expected. She states, and I quote, "I had a front row seat to the chaos that many families experience as they seek to coordinate care for a loved one. Her assumption that as a doctor, she could better than most easily expedite the quantity and quality of his home care was a, as she put it, a mistake. And I quote, I was just as overwhelmed as the next person. Cancer alters life. The diagnosis shifts life physically, emotionally, psychologically, concretely, financially, and for some people, spiritually. And life is altered not just for the person diagnosed with cancer, but for the caregiver and the family. I often say cancer is a family disease in that the cancer diagnosis causes a restructuring of how the family relates to each other and the roles and the responsibilities performed. So who is the caregiver, and what is self-care? These are questions that are asked all the time. The caregiver can be anyone that provides a substantive support for the person with cancer. A caregiver is the decision maker, the troubleshooter, the problem solver, the scheduler and planner, the manager, the intermediary between the patient and the medical system, the medicine preparer, the body care provider, the cook, performs the legal, financial, concrete needs of the patients, and sometimes is a home care and family systems fixer and maintainer. All of these or any of the above. The goal of the caregiver is to provide stability, direction, and comfort where there can be and often is uncertainty, confusion, complexity of emotions, and sometimes crisis and chaos. Caregiving can impact on how the patient learns to live and cope with cancer. At the same time, as Dr. Snyderman wisely realized, learning to live with cancer and cope with cancer is not just for the person with cancer. In fact, I would say that part of the job of the caregiver is also to learn to live with and cope with cancer. I would say that the caregiver is constantly learning, and it is essential to remember that constant learning is part and parcel of being a caregiver. And all that changes, all that learning changes as the patient's healthcare needs change during and after cancer treatment. Caregiving is a juggling act of stress and rewards and an ongoing rebalancing because cancer is in a constant state of change. So how do we self-care? This is as individual as each caregiver, although we can learn how to care for ourselves by learning from others. None of us were taught how to caregive, therefore we learn as we do. As we focus on the needs of the loved one with cancer, learning how to support them through the cancer experience, we often forget our own needs. As Dr. Snyderman says so eloquently in our article, I forgot to check in with myself. There is much information on the internet with other caregivers, professional supports, either individual and group. So without taking care of yourself, you cannot care for your loved one. The caregiver's stress can be just as significant as the stress of the person with cancer. However, the content of that stress is often very different. So caregiving will come with stress. It is a given. That is essential to know. How to care for oneself, as Dr. Snyderman says, is to remember to check in with yourself and learn to cope with stress as another essential aspect. Figure out what your stressors are. Often a stressor can be broken down into smaller stressors. So instead of seeing your stressor as a mountain, break it into smaller stressors, smaller hills instead of mountains. We must learn what we can change as caregivers, and if we cannot change the situation, we must learn how to change how we feel about the situation. Coping with cancer involves an awareness of the primary stressors and then breaking those primary stressors into smaller stressors. It is the hallmark of coping with stressors. Then with smaller stressors, one can focus on education and information that are relevant to those smaller stressors and learning to live with them. Coping with stress, education, and information are essentials. And again, remember that stressors, education, and information may change from diagnosis, when the patient is in the hospital, when the care is at home, at the start of treatment, at the end of treatment, and after treatment, and especially if cancer recurs, and if treatment becomes palliative, leading to hospice care. Communication is key and is another essential. Communicating with the person with cancer is the foundation of optimal caregiving. Without communicating with the person with cancer, caregiving can become a guessing game, which only exacerbates the stress. Remember, the person with cancer is the coach of the team, since their decisions are the decisions that drive the care that they're receiving, unless they are unable to make those decisions. And the caregiver is the quarterback. Therefore, the quarterback follows the directives of the coach. Create a team and divest yourself of every single caregiving responsibility and learn to delegate, delegate, delegate. Team creation is another essential. Often people say to a caregiver, call me if you need anything. They say this because they don't know what it is you need as a caregiver. Let them know what it is that you need and ask for support. Communicate with other caregivers. This is another essential. Find support. Create a team of caregivers on the phone or online. Visit the internet. Learn from other caregivers. You are not alone, although sometimes it feels that way. Half of caregivers report that they don't discuss their caregiver issues with anyone. But you are not alone, and your caregiving issues are shared by every single caregiver. Speak with a social worker at Cancer Care. Call the US2 Prostate Cancer Foundation. Call Immerman Angels. They're a help for cancer care caregivers. All of these organizations assist in helping you find other caregivers for support and for assistance. Communication is essential. Communication is especially essential with other caregivers and the person with cancer, especially for the long-distance caregiver. This situation comes with its own burden of stressors, such as guilt for not being physically present, greater complexity for not being in the loop, physically in the loop, relying on others who you cannot see but only can talk to, not being able to attend appointments, et cetera, et cetera. Again, speak with other caregivers, but most importantly, communicate with the local professionals that is associated with your loved one's care, a social worker, a patient navigator, a support group, a doctor, a nurse. Skype, email, texting will all assist with minimizing the obstacles of distance. And finally, for anyone with major illnesses, holidays, birthdays, and other special occasions have added significance. There's no one answer to coping with these important days. But I would say, once again, essential is communication. Communicating with the person with cancer, with other family members, with friends, and other caregivers. And as Dr. Snyderman stated, don't forget to check in with yourself. So I leave you with three important questions as a caregiver to constantly ask yourself. How do I feel? What do I need now? And what do I need in the future to continue to care for myself so that I can care for my loved one? And just as much as you would develop a self-care plan, a care plan for the loved one with cancer, develop your own self-care plan. Your needs as a caregiver are just as important as the needs of the person with cancer. Thank you, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you very much, Bill. That was really wonderful and very informative. And I think those three questions at the end that people need to ask themselves, I'll have you repeat that later on during the Q&A. That's really important. So thank you. The whole presentation was really focused on the needs of caregivers, and I hope you all found that helpful. Our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Cubbert, and Dr. Cubbert is an anesthesiologist at the Pain Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Cubbert is going to address managing symptoms, side effects, and pain, quality of life concerns, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to bring on Dr. Cubbert.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I think that symptom management, especially pain management, is extremely important in managing this disease. It's imperative that patients and their families do not allow uncontrolled pain to interfere with the functional status of the patient or the ability to comply with treating the cancer. Cancer pain can be caused for different reasons, the disease itself, chemotherapy, radiation treatments, or post-surgical pain. And some of the reasons that people experience pain are from painful bony metastasis. The mechanism of bone pain still remains incompletely understood. It's important to note that sometimes very small lesions will produce a great deal of pain and very large lesions will not. And for this reason, I feel that trying to track the disease progression is very difficult to judge by the pain itself. And people should not really do that and try to see how they're doing just by how their pain is. Bone pain is an example of what is called somatic type pain. This type of pain is usually well-localized, constant, aching, throbbing type of pain. A second type of pain that people need to be aware of is something called visceral pain, and that's when the disease travels to an organ. People kind of feel a deep, dull pain that can be associated with position or eating. The pain is not very well localized. An example would be if the prostate cancer goes to the liver and you feel pain primarily in your back. The pain can be coming from the liver, but people feel it more so in their thoracic spine area. Neuropathic pain occurs when there's invasion or injury to a nerve. And the feelings of discomfort that people experience are usually lancinating, electrical, or burning in nature. Nerve pain can occur when the disease invades a nerve. For instance, if a metastatic lesion would go to the rib, underneath the rib, there are a bunch of nerves called your intercostal nerves, and they can be involved. And that can cause a burning pain in the chest wall area. Sometimes various chemotherapies can cause neuropathies, and people feel pain in their feet. They feel needles-type sensation in their feet as well. Shingles pain would be another type of nerve pain that people experience, and just a light touch can cause discomfort. It's important for patients to understand the different types of pain to explain their symptoms to their healthcare provider. And pain needs to be treated and attacked in different ways. The chemotherapy can help lessen the pain, as well as radiation treatments. And then, of course, there are the medications. NSAIDs can be helpful for bone pain and can be a first-line treatment, and they're sold over the counter. But you have to remember that the toxic effects of taking NSAIDs can be a problem. Even though they're over the counter, they do have risks. And most of the risks are bleeding, especially GI bleeding with NSAID use. If a cancer patient's platelet count is low, which it is sometimes with chemotherapy, or patients are on Coumadin for blood clots, over-the-counter medication and NSAIDs are not the way to go. And because they're sold over-the-counter doesn't mean that they're safe. So opioids have been the mainstay of pain management for many years. And failure to use these drugs effectively and widespread can be blamed on three parties, the clinician, the pharmacies, and the patient. A lot of pharmacies won't carry these drugs. And you know, you read in the paper that there has been some robberies at pharmacies and for these drugs, for people abusing these drugs. And a lot of pharmacists are nervous about carrying these drugs. I always tell people to try the smaller pharmacies rather than the chains because they're more apt to get the less conventional drugs in as well. Sometimes physicians don't want to prescribe. In New York, every time we write an opioid prescription, we have to look up every patient to see if that patient is getting prescriptions from one provider. And if the physician doesn't look that patient up, she or he can be fined. But the main reason I hear that people are afraid to take these medications is a fear of addiction. And I think that it needs to be made perfectly clear that addiction to opioids is an extremely rare outcome of the use of opioids. And there's different types of addiction. There's psychological addiction, which is really aberrant behavior, where people use these meds basically to get high. And this doesn't occur in people with cancer who have real pain. Physical addiction or physical dependence, however, does occur. And this means that if you're taking these meds for a period of time, you can't abruptly stop them or you go through withdrawal. So if the pain decreases and you're on these meds, you actually need to be weaned off. And some people need to be weaned off slower than others, and everyone is different. Other people feel that if I take the drug now, it won't work when I really, really need it. And first of all, pain does not necessarily worsen if the extent of the disease worsens. And tolerance seems to occur to the side effects of these drugs, like sedation, nausea, itching, but not the ability of the drug to control the pain. If the pain worsens while you're on these drugs, it's more likely that the pain relief wasn't adequate to begin with, or something else might be going on rather than that the patient has become tolerant to the pain medication. Pain that is constant, that requires taking something 3 or 4 times a day, would be better off if it was treated more on an around-the-clock basis. By using this approach, the patient prevents the pain rather than always trying to catch up. And there are many opioids on the market that are considered longer-acting. There are long-acting morphine preparations like MS-Contin. There are long-acting oxycodone preparations like OxyContin. There's a long-acting Dilaudid preparation, Exalgo. There's a long-acting oxymorphone preparation called Opana. And there are a lot of options. Any drug with an ER, stands for extended release, SR, slow release, or ends in contin, which means continuous, implies that it's longer acting. There are also altered other delivery systems, such as a fentanyl patch, which delivers the medicine continuously, subcutaneously, at a constant rate. And this is also considered a long-acting opioid. So finding the correct drug sometimes is a little bit of trial and error. One may cause side effects, another won't. One might work better for one person and not for the other. The reasons aren't really clearly known. The key is to really work with your physician to find the correct drug and titrate it up to the right level. And the right level is really the amount that takes away the majority of the pain during the day. On a scale of 0 to 10, we usually shoot for about a 2. And, of course, you want to try to treat the side effects and find the medication that causes the least amount of side effects. A long time ago, scientists at Memorial came up with an opioid conversion chart, and they were able to compare the strength of each opioid to each other. And what they found is that morphine really isn't that strong. People usually get caught up in the names of things, and they think morphine, oh my goodness, but it's not really that strong, and the key is really not to get caught up in the name or the dose. The strength of these drugs is dose-dependent, and taking a drug that has a name like morphine might not be as strong as you think if you're taking less of a dose. So despite an effective preventive schedule with a long-acting opioid, some people still have breakthrough pain and need extra medicines. And these meds are more of the shorter-acting forms of the longer-acting drug, and they last for about 4 hours. And they're used primarily to supplement the long-acting drug. Examples would be Dilaudid, oxycodone, hydrocodone, morphine, and Opana. You have to remember that some of these drugs are combined with Tylenol, like oxycodone with Tylenol is Percocet, and hydrocodone with Tylenol is Vicodin. It's important that understanding that taking too much Tylenol, usually we say 2 grams, is not really good for your liver. So even though you think of Vicodin as a pretty benign drug that you might even take after a tooth extraction, taking a lot of it is not a good thing for you. Opioid medication does have side effects. Sedation, nausea, and constipation, people get it. But they seem to get tolerant to a lot of the side effects if you take it for a long time. Except constipation. You never get tolerant to the constipation. So if you're going to take an opioid regimen, you must take stool softeners and laxatives at the same time to prevent the constipation. Like pain, it's always better to prevent constipation than to start treating it once it's started. And we usually start people on Colace and Seneca when we start an opioid regimen as well. Sometimes opioids don't work as well for neuropathic pain. We have to use either higher doses of the opioid or we add supplements such as antidepressants or anti-convulsive medications or seizure medications along with the opioids to control the neuropathic pain. Neurontin is a common neuropathic agent that's been around for many years. Side effects include dizziness and weight gain. And Lyrica, which you've probably seen on TV, acts on similar receptors and is really the new improved Neurontin. I'm sure that when you listen to the commercials, they don't sound like such a great, it doesn't sound like such a great drug because they list a million side effects. And I'm sure there's somebody out there who's taken it and it's made them feel really odd. But for the most part, it's pretty well tolerated. You have to start at a really low dose and sort of work your way up. And we've kind of learned that by trial and error as well. The key to limiting side effects to any medicines is to be in contact with your healthcare provider, start at light, low doses, and titrate upwards effectively. Antidepressants like Cymbalta can also be used to control nerve and muscle pain as well. So if oral medications don't work as well as you'd like them to, sometimes giving pain medicines through a different mechanism can be helpful. And at that time, we might go to spinal opioids. I mean, they can be delivered through what we call an intrathecal pump. The pump is actually implanted into the abdominal wall, and the catheter is placed into the spinal space. The pump acts like a computer and can be set to deliver the medicine very accurately to the spinal space. The advantage of this method is hopefully better analgesia, but definitely less side effects. And when we deliver opioids to the spinal space, we can deliver a less amount of drug with the same potency. So if I was to give you 100 milligrams of oral morphine orally, I might only have to give you 1 milligram intraspinally, which definitely cuts down on the side effects of these medicines. Also, numbing medicines, such as Marcaine, can be placed in the pump in a way that numbs the pain but doesn't numb the person, doesn't numb motor function. This is just an alternative way of giving the medicines, and it's another option. Sometimes it's possible to isolate particular nerves which are producing the pain, and nerve blocks can be used to try to help treat the pain. Cortisone sometimes can be a temporary measure to control pain. And actually destroying the nerve which is responsible for the pain with either heat or cold source or a chemical agent like alcohol can sometimes alleviate the pain as well. So in conclusion, no one should suffer from pain. There's a lot of treatments out there for pain. Pain can become the major source of distress that as you go through this process, and it can cause depression, anxiety, fatigue, and not wanting to eat, and that all these reasons are why good pain management is so important. It's impossible to go through the treatment, live your life with uncontrolled pain, and in this day and age, no one really should. There's so many things to try, and there are so many options that no one really should have to be. Go through this process and go through it with pain. Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Dr. Covert. That's a wonderful, very comprehensive and very informative, and I think your message about not having to have pain, there are so many options for people to get care for their pain. So thank you for that message to everybody on the call. Now, I want to thank all of our speakers, and we now have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board now, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, please call Cancer Care at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that again later on. But for now, let's see how many questions we can take right now. So, Sam, could you explain to the audience how to queue up, and we'll see how many we can take. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit your questions by clicking on the Ask a Question button.
We have a question from one of our online participants. What should I do to prepare for a doctor's visit? So Dr. Slovin, would you like to address that first, and then I'll ask others to key in as well.
I think that's a superb question. The most important piece of advice I could give you is don't go to a doctor's visit yourself. you hear things, but frankly, people are in such a state of apprehension and anxiety that they really sometimes don't hear what the doctor is saying. So it's very helpful to have a friend, a spouse, a child, you know, somebody who can just go with you. It could be your next-door neighbor, somebody whom you trust who has a pencil and paper and can take notes so that they could ask questions or make notes that they could present to you, particularly if you're not at all familiar. You know, a good doctor and a good nurse will sit down and discuss options with you. They will go over treatments, go over the schedules. They will tell you the kinds of treatments that are needed and the associated side effects. In preparing for a doctor's appointment, I think the most important thing that you can do is try to establish trust and be relaxed. It's hard to do, no question about that, but reading about every nuance of your disease can be extremely confusing and very overwhelming. Also, talking to well-meaning relatives or neighbors or friends can also be very overwhelming, particularly when you're not certain as to why you won't get the same treatment as your next-door neighbor. And so I tell people when they come in for the first time to come in with an open mind. It's the doctor's role as well as the nurse's role to really educate the patient, to make them aware of what the nature of their disease is, the biologic behavior of the disease, and then try to explain in the most meaningful way as possible what the best treatment approach would be. Now, that sometimes is not established at the first meeting. The first meeting is often used as a sort of how do you do, and the patients are often asked to get imaging studies and other tests, and it's at that next visit where you really need to know how to prepare yourself. So, if you've had a bone and CAT scan, you need to come in with a list of questions that ask the doctor, okay, doctor, what are the results and how do I interpret this? What does this mean for me or my cancer? People often go mute when they go into a doctor's office. They don't know what to say or how to say it. And it's just as if you were having a conversation with anybody. Feel free to ask the questions. Ask, you know, if the doctor is not explaining it well enough, please say to the doctor, look, I really don't understand. Can you give me an example? And doctors will often sit down, draw things for you, or explain it. So while I'd like to say you need to go on the Internet and explore other things, I would tell people to go in with an open mind because you're less anxious, you're less trying to make connections with things you've read compared to what the doctor is telling you. You have time to do that once a treatment has been established. I'm hoping that's helpful.
Well, that's excellent. Thank you. And that's very helpful. And Mr. Gordon, do you want to add to that in terms of how to prepare for those visits?
I think Dr. Slovin really covered all the bases so eloquently and so comprehensively. I would just add to that, and this is what we recommend to clients who call here, whether they're the person with cancer or the caregiver, is to get yourself a notebook and to break that notebook down into different sections to keep yourself organized. Because as both Dr. Slovin and Dr. Cubbert have said, so much information is going to be coming to you, and it does get overwhelming, even if you are able to stay as present as one could possibly be during the meeting with the physician. So get yourself a notebook. Break it down into sections, and also use it as a diary so that you know on a specific date that you had a PET scan, a bone scan, a CAT scan, and that on the next date you have met with a doctor, and write 3 or 4 questions in preparation that are really essential for you at that time that really will answer those questions you need to really comprehend and understand what is going on, what's going on with your health, and what the immediate future might be.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Cubbert, do you want to add anything as well?
Yeah, I think that's very important to write things down before you come, because people just forget to ask questions. And you know, what to expect and what's next and things like that. As far as pain goes, it's really important to write down what you're taking and how often you're taking it and how you feel during the day and things like that, and when the pain is worse. And if you can kind of keep a pain diary, it really helps try to figure that out.
Excellent. These are wonderful suggestions for everybody, so I hope That helps with our online participant question, but I hope it helps everybody on the call as well. We have another question from one of our online participants. How do I find out about caregiving services in my community? So, Mr. Gorin, could you address that question?
There are many ways to find out about caregiving services in your community. First of all, I would start with your immediate community and speak to any of the local people that you've associated with yourself in terms of a social worker, a patient navigator that might be a patient representative at the hospital or the clinic that you're going to. You may also want to talk to other patients on other caregivers within your community. If not, Cancer Care's Hope Line, 1-800 Hope Line, will be an essential support system for you in order to help you fine-tune that research. And if you have access to the web, there are caregiving associations that are both general and cancer-related that would assist you with finding out what local or national supports you may need, whether you're a local hands-on caregiver or whether you're a long-distance caregiver.
Thank you. Our next question from one of our online participants is, how can I recognize my own sadness or depression when taking care of my partner with prostate cancer and help myself? Again, Mr. Warren, could you address that question?
That is such a wonderful question, and I applaud this person for being able to honestly and courageously identify what they're going through. And I think as we work with our loved ones who have cancer, we realize that we have a range and a spectrum of responses to what's happening to them in terms of the cancer and to and in terms of treatments and side effects of treatment, especially with prostate cancer, in terms of some of the big side effects, incontinence and impotency. And again, I would reach out to other caregivers who are going through similar situations, either through the Cancer Care Hope Line. Immerman Angels is a peer matching support organization that will help you find other people in the country who are as similar to you and your situation as you are. Again, I would reach out to support. As we say, you know, cancer is a family disease, so that we offer here at Cancer Care our services to both the person with cancer and the caregiver, because we identify and recognize that caregivers have as great a response to the cancer situation as the person with cancer, so that these accompanying feelings of sadness, depression, anxiety, stress are all part and parcel of learning to cope with cancer. So reaching out to a social worker, reaching out to a psychologist, talking with the oncologist as the caregiver are all part of creating a support network for yourself as the caregiver. Remember, to create your own self-care plan is essential and part of the caregiving process.
And Dr. Slovin and Dr. Kubert, do you want to comment on just the mechanism within a medical center when a caregiver comes in and is having some difficulty, how that is, how the staff that are there to help them in terms of the...
Well, first of all, the most important thing, I think, is recognition of the problem. So I salute anybody who feels that they need help and they're willing to acknowledge it. I think in our clinic, we try to treat the couple. It's not just the patient, but the person who's taking care of that person. And recognize that sometimes in the course of our visit, it becomes about the caregiver and not about the patient. And when I start to see that happening, or I see the caregiver talking more about herself or himself, then I am alerted to the possibility that there's something else that's going on. And there's a lot of stress between couples. At Memorial, for example, we have a couples therapy that is to try to help both the patient and the partner deal with the stresses. And then we make very good use of our social work team and sometimes patient representative to really make sure that the patient has as much support as he needs. And that goes true for the caretaker. So really the counseling can be on the part of the social worker. It can be on the part of patient representative. And sometimes even psychiatry plays a very important role. You know, we tell people it's okay to ask for help. It's temporary. It gets you through a crisis, and then you'll be much steadier in terms of going forward. And I think people have come to appreciate that they're not going crazy, everybody's okay, and that this is just an adjustment that they have to make to change their lives, but they can get through it. And I would say that almost 98% of people do get through it.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Cupboard, do you want to add anything?
I think it's important for the caregiver to realize also that, you know, it's sometimes you need a break. And it's important to identify someone or somebody in the family or a friend to help you out and take a break every once in a while, because this, you know, this could be a very long road and it's very, very trying trying experience. It's just extremely important to step away every once in a while and to gather yourself and do something for yourself as well.
Excellent. These are all excellent points, and thank you all very much. This is wonderful. And the next question from one of our online participants is, are there genes that put me at greater risk of getting prostate cancer? So clearly a family member, these are questions that often come up in terms of familial risk of developing prostate cancer. I'm wondering, Dr. Slovin, if you could address that.
Yes, another, I would say, outstanding question. If your father has prostate cancer, that is not really a significant family history. Your risk is about twofold higher than the man next door. Family history, or patients who are at significant risk, is a patient whose perhaps father and grandfather, or father and brother, or father, brother, uncle, all have had prostate cancer. So it's more than just your father. It needs to be one or more first-degree relatives that really makes this a family history per se. Similarly, the African-American population, by virtue of the color of their skin, tends to have a much higher risk of prostate cancer. And in both groups of patients, those with the family history and those with the known ethnicity that contributes to their prostate cancer, really need to undergo prostate cancer screening a lot sooner. We still are not searching randomly for any sort of genetic mutations. There is a subgroup of men whose family history in a mother or a sister, for example, have ovarian and or breast cancer, may have what we call the BRCA2 mutation, which also puts them at risk for breast cancer. So really, those are the three main risks. We are not screening for the BRCA2 routinely because, again, it really depends on the family history, and that's something that we learn about at the first time that we meet a patient. But very good question.
Okay. And then another question, which really comes up a lot in the programs, and it's from one of our online participants. What role do diet and dietary supplements play in prostate cancer? So, Dr. Slovin, can you address that? Because that's always an issue about, is there anything that one can do?
Absolutely. We know based on a lot of studies from Harvard, for example, that fat does play a role in the diet. We know that people who have a sedentary existence or are obese or older or all of the above have a higher risk of prostate cancer. Now, this may not turn into being a virulent form of prostate cancer. In fact, it may be very quiescent. But I've had patients who have failed surgery or radiation or both and have rising PSAs as the only indication of their disease. And when they lose a good 10 or 15 pounds or change their diet to include fish, chicken, white meat, turkey, low-fat dairy products, that many of them actually have a modulation or slowing in the rate of rise of their PSA. I have often scolded people for overindulging, not so much in desserts or meat products or anything like that, but, for example, alcohol. Remember, alcohol is carbohydrate, gets converted into sugar and then glycogen for storage in the liver, and it's fat. So I've actually had people modulate how much alcohol, limit it to no more than 4 ounces of wine or one cocktail or one beer, and not all of the above. I have some patients who clearly do not drink during the week, but then if there's a football game on the weekend, they can drink a case of beer, and they can start having shots with the beer. And believe me when I tell you, it's very reflective when they come into clinic the next day because their liver tests are way offline, and their PSA sometimes will shoot up as well. Not all the time, but some of the time. So, you know, people, I tell people that they should have dairy because you need calcium in your diet. They should be active, and they should also be aware that they can have meat. You may want to limit it to once a week, which is perfectly fine, and no more than 4 ounces of a good cut of beef. Alternative drugs or alternative vitamins or what we call nutraceuticals are still, they're still drugs. They are not regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, and I often am wary about people who take these things indiscriminately, even though they may be under the auspices of a physician who perhaps is involved with alternative therapies. So, for example, I had a patient who took a lot of milkweed thistle, and one day he came in, perfectly healthy man, and his liver tests were sky high, and it got to the point that I had to have a biopsy performed, and this man was very clear to going into full liver failure. So a lot of the alternatives that are out there are not strongly predicated on studies that are incorporated into very high-profile journals. There may be some reports, but you have to be very, very circumspect about the literature and not believe everything that one reads. You need to analyze it. You need to talk to people who are in the field before you really go forward with taking some of these alternative drugs. So I have nothing against people taking vitamin C, but remember, after 500 milligram tablet, everything else that you take, you will urinate out. You know, it'll be in the urine, so it's of no benefit to take grams and grams. And so, you know, again, what I would recommend to you is very strongly to talk to your doctor before you even embark on these medications and get a perspective and make sure that if you do decide to take something to supplement your diet, that at least it has very limited toxicity and will not affect any of the medications that you're taking.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Kubit, if you could address actually the issue of exercise, particularly when people have pain, if you could just help people with some guidelines around about just movement and exercise. Is that how do people work out a regimen around that when they're having some
pain? Surely it's always better to move than to not move. Staying in bed, staying in a chair is never the answer to help your function. Also on the ideas of alternative approaches to pain. I think that things like acupuncture can be very helpful, especially for nausea after chemo and for pain. So alternative things like that are very, very helpful and have really no downside to it. And I can speak because I also am a licensed acupuncturist as well. I think massage, hypnosis, and biofeedback and anything that will help dealing with the pain is also helpful, and physical exercise also puts you in a better state of mind as well.
Excellent. Well, I have to say I want to thank all of our speakers. Really just phenomenal presentations today. I hope this has helped our caregivers. I want to thank all of the questions from our online participants today. Really, really helped to expand the call and help us address other areas of concern to all of you. I do want to, and all of you who are listening, I want to thank you as well. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning this program, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so as this program is winding down and will soon conclude, I don't want you to think that you're alone and that we're just leaving you out there with no help or no one to contact. You can contact our social work staff. We have about 35 social work staff at Cancer Care. You can contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE. We provide a host of services from practical and financial assistance to counseling, and that means a chance to talk with someone about your concerns. Also, we have support groups on the telephone online. We have lots of different materials we can send you, booklets and fact sheets, and, of course, we have many of these workshops as well. So most importantly, I don't want you to think that you're alone in coping with metastatic prostate cancer or cancer in general. I want you to know that you're now part of this community of support, and we are here really to help you. And we are simply a phone call away, or you can visit our website as well. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may all disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.